and welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from CNN, from the New York Times, from the Associated Press, and more. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. We begin this week on Religion in the News with an analysis by CNN religion editor Daniel Burke entitled Jerry Falwell Jr.'s Fatal Miscalculation. And this is in response to Jerry Falwell Jr. Resigning as president of Liberty University a few weeks ago. Last fall, as scrutiny of his leadership of Liberty University began to intensify, Jerry Falwell Jr. revealed to a CNN reporter one of the secrets of his school's success. It didn't start, he said, with his famous father, the Reverend Jerry Falwell, who built the religious right, starred in the old-time Gospel Hour on TV, and founded the Evangelical College in Lynchburg, Virginia. Instead, Falwell Jr. praised the pluck and moral flexibility of his grandfather, a bootlegger who delivered moonshine to Virginia hill dwellers during Prohibition. Dismissive of organized religion, Kerry Falwell died at age 55 with a hip flask in his pocket and an unsaved soul, his grandson said. My father became a Christian, said Falwell Jr., but he took that same entrepreneurial spirit into the religious world, and that's why Liberty is where it is today. Falwell Jr., whose tenure as president and chancellor of Liberty University crashed to an inglorious end this week, always seemed closer in spirit to his defiant bootlegging grandfather than his Bible-thumping namesake. In recent years, he has tweeted racist photos and told students that if more people carried guns, we could end these Muslims before they walk in. He has called a parent concerned about coronavirus on campus a dummy and told a pastor to grow a pair. He has posted pictures from a party on a yacht suggesting activities that would violate his own school's honor code, and he has fervently supported Donald Trump, comparing him to Jesus and excusing all manner of unchristlike behavior. Each time, Falwell would insist he's not a moral leader. His job was to grow Liberty's endowment, campus, and student body. I've never been a minister, he told one critic on Twitter, pointing to his background as a lawyer and real estate developer. The faculty, students, and campus pastor are the ones who keep LU strong spiritually as the best Christian university in the world, he added. While I am proud to be a conservative Christian, my job is to keep LU successful academically, financially, and in athletics. It seems strange to hear the heir to the moral majority's founder and the leader of a school that aims to train champions for Christ disavowing the responsibility to live a Christian life. But it worked for a while because by most worldly measures, Falwell Jr. was a raging success. He oversaw $1 billion in new construction projects, pioneered online learning platforms that boosted enrollment, and brought Liberty's football and basketball teams to Division I, the most competitive level of college sports. Somehow, amid all of this success, Liberty quietly cut the budget at its divinity school. Did it matter if Falwell Jr. sometimes acted more like the president of a frat than the country's largest Christian university? Ultimately, yes. Saying that he was just a real estate lawyer and not a moral leader was not a luxury he had, said one former Liberty University official who asked to remain anonymous. Falwell Jr. likely assumed that as long as he kept Liberty rolling in money, no one would care much about his personal morality. That, the former Liberty official told CNN, was a fatal miscalculation. Falwell Jr.'s latest scandal blew up on Monday when a young Miami man went public with allegations that he and Falwell's wife, Becky, had regular sexual liaisons for years, sometimes while Falwell looked on. A day earlier, in an apparent attempt to preempt the allegations, Falwell publicly acknowledged that Becky had an inappropriate personal relationship with a man, but said that he himself was not involved. Falwell also accused the Miami man, Giancarlo Granda, of blackmailing him and his wife, a charge Granda adamantly denies. A former hotel pool attendant who met the Falwells at a luxury hotel in Miami in 2012, Granda said the Falwells initiated the affair and are victim-shaming. Granda said his sexual relationship with the Falwells lasted until 2019 and included trips to the family's farm and to meet President Trump. By this time, Falwell's tenure at the school was already in jeopardy. He had been placed on temporary leave by Liberty's Board of Trustees on August 7th after he posted a photo on Instagram that showed him with his pants unzipped and his midsection visible. In the photo, Falwell is holding a cup of dark liquid and has one arm around a woman whose shorts are also unzipped. Falwell later apologized and told a radio station the photo was just good fun. The school's bylaws appear to disagree. The president, they say, should provide spiritual and worldview leadership to the university in the pursuit of excellence. Karen Swallow Pryor, a former professor at Liberty, said Falwell ruled the campus with virtually unchecked power. The kinds of things that have been revealed over the past couple of days are not things that happen in isolation, Pryor told CNN this week. There have been red flags for a long time, she added. The kind of arrogance and authoritarian leadership that we experience as faculty was really just a symptom of this lifestyle that obviously was one in which he thought he could do anything and get away with it. Falwell did not respond to requests for comment for this story. The spotlight on Falwell Jr. intensified when he became one of the first prominent evangelicals to back Trump in early 2016, surprising fellow Christian conservatives. During a Trump campaign visit to Liberty, Falwell glowingly compared the candidate to his late father due to their shared propensity for eschewing political correctness. Echoing his own self-defense, Falwell excused the twice-divorced casino magnate's moral failings, praising Trump's business success and arguing that Americans were electing a president, not a pastor. Falwell was fiercely loyal to Trump, appearing at campaign events with him and saying that there was nothing the candidate could do to lose his vote. Our whole faith is based around the idea that we're all equally bad, he told CNN when asked about a videotape in which Trump bragged about grabbing women in the genitals. We're all sinners. We all need Christ's forgiveness. Current and former Liberty officials, who ask not to be named, say Falwell's personality changed as his political profile grew. The Jerry that I knew was very introverted, almost a loner, said the former Liberty University official. While acknowledging his wife's affair, Falwell Jr. said this week that it was awkward to be thrust into the spotlight when he became Liberty's president in 2007 after the death of his famous father. I quickly and unexpectedly went from being the lawyer working in the background on the business aspects of the school to becoming a very public person, having to overcome my fears of speaking in front of audiences of tens of thousands, Falwell said. Eventually, Falwell grew into the role, reveling in Liberty's prominence as a political power center of evangelicalism. GOP candidates and office holders often came to address Liberty students, and Falwell basked in the attention. After he endorsed Trump, the media came banging down Falwell's door, intrigued that a prominent evangelical and a Falwell would support the least conventionally religious candidate in the field. Then all of a sudden he's on TV and introducing Trump at rallies, said the former Liberty official. That's heady stuff, and I think he got reckless. For years, a handful of Liberty students and alumni had lobbied the school's board of trustees to remove Falwell. But his family's name, political connections, and financial success at Liberty, including an endowment that grew to $1.6 billion, made him untouchable. This summer, as Falwell's indiscretions mounted, the trickle of criticism became a flood. Calling his behavior appalling, a congressman urged him to resign. So did prominent evangelicals in an alumni-led petition urging Falwell to stop this infantile behavior and lead our alma mater with dignity, as your father did, drew nearly 40,000 signatures. Falwell's zipper has been down for a long time, wrote Callum Best, a 2020 Liberty graduate, in an online opinion column. We've seen everything, and it's too disturbing to stay quiet. Then came the revelations of the affair with Granda. The irony was almost too obvious. As Falwell benefited from Liberty's growing reputation as a center of Christian conservatism, he appeared to be flouting the very beliefs that accounted for its moral power. When a conservative Christian gets snared in a sex scandal, critics immediately cry hypocrisy, as if one sinner's fall discredits an entire faith. But Jerry Falwell Jr. wasn't a hypocrite. He never pretended to be holier than thou. Like many successful capitalists, he believed that money made him invulnerable. His fatal sin wasn't hypocrisy. It was hubris. Our next article this week is from the August 28th edition of the New York Times, and the article is entitled, God is Dead, So is the Office. These people want to save both. In the subheadline, Divinity Consultants are designing sacred rituals for corporations and their spiritually depleted employees. And this is by Nellie Bowles of the New York Times. In the beginning, there was COVID-19, and the tribe of the white collars rent their garments, for their workdays were a formless void and all their rituals were gone. New routines came to replace the old, but the routines were scattered, and there was chaos around how best to exit a Zoom, onboard an intern, end a work week. The Adrift may yet find purpose, for a new corporate clergy has arisen to formalize the remote work life. They go by different names: ritual consultants, sacred designers, soul-centered advertisers. They have degrees from divinity schools. Their business is borrowing from religious tradition to bring spiritual richness to corporate America. In simpler times, divinity schools sent their graduates out to lead congregations or conduct academic research. Now there is a more office-bound calling, the spiritual consultant. Those who have chosen this path who have founded agencies, some for-profit, some not, with similar-sounding names, Sacred Design Lab, Ritual Design Lab, Ritualist. They blend the obscure language of the sacred with the also obscure language of management consulting to provide clients with a range of spiritually inflected services, from architecture to employee training to ritual design. Their larger goal is to soften cruel capitalism, making space for the soul, and to encourage employees to ask if what they are doing is good in a higher sense. Having watched social justice get readily absorbed into corporate culture, they want to see if more American businesses are ready for faith. "We've seen brands enter the political space," said Casper Terquilli, a co-founder of Sacred Design Lab. Citing a Vice report, he added, "The next white space in advertising and brands is spirituality." Before the pandemic, these agencies got their footing helping companies with design, refining their products, physical spaces, and branding. They also consulted on strategy, workflow, and staff management. With digital workers stuck at home since March, a new opportunity has emerged. Employers are finding their workers atomized and agitated and are looking for guidance to bring them back together. Now the sacred consultants are helping to usher in new rituals for shapeless workdays and trying to give employees routines that are imbued with meaning. Ezra Bookman founded Ritualist, which describes itself as a boutique consultancy transforming companies and communities through the art of ritual, last year in Brooklyn. He has come up with rituals for small firms for events like the successful completion of a project, or if one fails, a funeral. "How do we help people process the grief when a project fails and help them move on from it?" Mr. Bookman said. Messages on the startup's Instagram feed read like a kind of menu for companies who want to buy operational rights a la carte. A ritual for purchasing your domain name, aka your little plot of virtual land up in the clouds. A ritual for when you get the email from LegalZoom that you've been officially registered as an LLC. The sacred consultant trend might be led by the co-founders of Sacred Design Lab, Mr. Terquil, Angie Thurston, and Sue Phillips. They met at Harvard Divinity School, where they remain affiliated as inaugural Ministry Innovation Fellows, and founded their organization as a nonprofit in 2019. Their backgrounds vary. Mr. Terquil, who lives in Brooklyn and co-hosts a popular Harry Potter podcast, wrote a book on how to transform common everyday practices, yoga, reading, walking the dog, into sacred rituals. Ms. Thurston, who lives in Alexandria, Virginia, had worked at finding spiritual connection between people of different faiths. Ms. Phillips of Tacoma, Washington, is an ordained minister in the Unitarian Universalist tradition. What they have in common is an agreement that traditional religious institutions are not working and that corporate culture is largely soulless. At Harvard Divinity School, scholars have been studying the trend away from organized religion for decades. Their consensus is that while attendance at formal services is at a historic low, people are still looking for meaning and spirituality. Dudley Rose, the Associate Dean for Ministry Studies, noted that secular spaces were doing a surprisingly good job of fulfilling this desire. People were meeting what they identified as spiritual needs, but doing them in organizations that had no apparent spiritual connection, Mr. Rose said in an interview, like SoulCycle. People would cite SoulCycle. Mr. Terquil, Ms. Thurston, and Ms. Phillips saw it like this. If part of religious work is finding people in need wherever they are, then spiritual innovators should go toward the workplace. Regardless of what you and I might think about it, the fact is that people are showing up in the workplace with these big deficits in themselves when it comes to belonging and connection to the beyond, Ms. Thurston said. The Sacred Design Lab trio use the language of faith and church to talk about their efforts. They talk about organized religion as a technology for delivering meaning. The question we ask is, how do you translate the ancient traditions that have given people access to meaning-making practices, but in a context that is not centered around the congregation, Mr. Terquil said. The nonprofit says it has been thinking of sacred designs for companies like Pinterest, IDEO, and the Obama Foundation. Ms. Phillips doesn't see corporations replacing organized religion, but she said she does see an opportunity for companies to bring people some of the meaning that they used to derive from churches, temples, mosques, and the like. She talks about her work like a pastor would. "We spend a lot of time doing witness and accompaniment of our clients," she said. "We listen to their stories. We want to understand their lives. We want to understand their passion and their longing." Evan Sharp, the co-founder of Pinterest, hired Sacred Design Lab to categorize all major religious practices and think of ways to apply them to the office. They made him a spreadsheet. "We pulled together hundreds of practices from all these different religions and cultural practices and put them in a spreadsheet and just tried to categorize them by emotional state, which ones are relevant when you're happy, which are relevant when you're angry, and a couple other pieces of metadata," Mr. Sharp said. When he had the data, he said, he took a few days and read it all. "This sounds embarrassingly basic," he said, "but it really reframed parts of religion for me." It made him realize how many useful tools existed inside something as old-fashioned as his childhood church. "Some of the rituals I grew up with in Protestantism really have emotional utility," he said, and Mr. Sharp saw that it was good. There are perils, of course, with bringing elements of spirituality into the office. The mixture of corporate and religious language can be odd. For example, here's how Mr. Terquil described his work for a tech company he declined to name. "We researched and authored a concept paper on the soul of work to stimulate bold ideas about how soul-centeredness will continue to grow as a core element of the future of work." Another challenge is that many workers are already devout on their own terms on their own time and are not at all hungry for soul-based activities between 9 and 5. And it's hard to exhort workers to give their professional activities transcendental meaning when at the same time those workers can be terminated. It can be done badly, and when done badly, it can cause harm, as Thurston said. For example, how can we be in deep community if I can fire you? Ms. Thurston cited a host of possible problems to grapple with, creating a workplace religion, mixing management and soulfulness, getting paid for spirituality. "Even if this is all done well and a workplace becomes really soul-centered, it's still an office," Ms. Thurston said. "These are the challenges." Companies hiring ritual consultants may think they are bringing workers a small perk, but those behind the movement are hoping for a bigger revolution. Workers have achieved measured success recently at pressuring employers to address systemic racism. Some companies are making Juneteenth a paid holiday, for example, and investing in black and minority-owned ventures. And the Sacred Design consultants are wondering if employees might also begin to demand spiritual goodness. This possibility is what drew Bob Boyster to the Divinity Consultants. He is the chief executive of the Fetzer Institute, a Michigan nonprofit foundation that says its mission is helping build the spiritual foundation for a loving world and which helps fund Sacred Design Lab. Mr. Boyster said he hopes the group's work could eventually allow corporate employees to articulate complaints and stop projects or practices that they see as lucrative but immoral. "We today pay attention to a business's profits. The deeper question is whether the business ennobles or debases human existence," Mr. Boyster said. "We encourage employees to bring moral concerns into the business conversation." And so the consultants find rituals and religious language and pull them out of their religious context, the better in theory to keep workers from feeling alienated. But rituals without religion can go haywire. Tara Isabella Burton, the author of Strange Rites, New Religions for a Godless World, calls it the bespokification of religion, or the unbundling of rituals, a reference to how cable TV packages split apart after the advent of streaming services. In the unbundled world, people pick what they want from different faiths and incorporate it into their lives. A little Buddhism here, a little Kabbalah there. It is consumer-driven religiosity. The idea is that what we want, what feels good to us, what we desire, that all of this is constitutive of who we are, rather than community, Ms. Burton said. We risk seeing spirituality as something we can consume, something for us, something for our brand. In a workday spent at home, standing in front of a computer while meetings come and go, projects are received and filed, there is no differentiation. Every activity is physically the same. I'm hungry for ritual. Every day I get dressed, put on shoes, make coffee, pour it in a mug, and tell my two housemates that I'm heading to work and we'll see them later. Then I walk in a few circles and settle in at a desk in the corner of our living room just a couple feet away. This is my deranged coronavirus commute, and it's how I help my bleary mind realize that the workday has begun. If my boss said we would be instituting a one-minute group breathing exercise in the evenings to mark the closing of our laptops, or beginning each meeting by all smelling a clove together, would I like it? I would. it's easy to blur the line between routine and ritual. Which category is it, for example, to have a habit of taking a shower and staring at the ceiling for 5 minutes after accomplishing my day's main task? Does the label matter if the action feels essential? To be technical, though, Kathleen McTighe, a Unitarian Universalist minister and a mentor to Mr. Terquil, offers a definition. She describes rituals as elevated routines with set intention, attention, and repetition. Kurzat Ozenk has been in the corporate ritual game for a while as a product designer at the software giant SAP. He wrote Rituals for Work last year, and in January we'll publish a follow-up of sorts, Rituals for Virtual Meetings. I called him for recommendations on how to deepen my Zoom practice. Mr. Ozenk advised incorporating thoughtful interruptions. He suggested beginning conference calls with a moment of silence. He recently heard about a smelling ritual where everyone in a meeting retrieves a common kitchen spice, maybe cinnamon, and smells it at the same time to get a co-sensory experience. He's hoping to incorporate this into his guidance as a way to bind people together. In the physical world, we experience the same senses together, the same temperature, the same smell of food heating up, Mr. Ozenk said. Ms. Phillips, the minister, had a few other ideas. She suggested using a repetitive meeting structure which can be calming for participants. This might take the form of starting each team meeting with the same words, a sort of corporate incantation. Others suggested workers each light a candle at the start of a meeting or pick up a common object that everyone is likely to have in their homes. Glenn Fajardo, a teaching fellow and lecturer at Stanford's Design School who is researching rituals for virtual work, said to think of the workday like a movie, with structure and cuts and suspense based on predictable arcs. Say to the group, during this part of the conversation, everyone's going to turn off our video, Mr. Fajardo said, or while we're doing this activity, I want you to look at your notebook. Part of what you're doing with ritual is creating these chunks people can remember, creating this element of something familiar and something new. Jeffrey D. Lee, the bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Chicago, helped organize a 3-day retreat last year with Mr. Terquil and others. The purpose of the retreat was to allow spiritual entrepreneurs to brainstorm with traditional religious leaders. He described one participant as an experienced designer creating potent rituals for executives. Bishop Lee said he was happy to find the religious impulse at play, even if it was in places where the ultimate calling was profit. We're really aware of being on the shadow side of religious observance, a truly historic decline, he said. So there's some good news in here for how people are hungry for ritual. We'll continue on religion in the news with an article from August 30th on the Associated Press entitled, What Happens When Pandemic Locks Down a Globetrotting Pope? This is by Nicole Winfield of the AP, Dateline Rome. On the March day that Italy recorded its single biggest jump in coronavirus fatalities, Pope Francis emerged from lockdown to offer an extraordinary prayer and plea to his flock to reassess their priorities, arguing the virus had proved they needed one another. Francis' words from the rain-slicked promenade of St. Peter's Basilica encapsulated the core messages he has emphasized during his 7-year pontificate: solidarity, social justice, and care for the most vulnerable. But the dramatic moment also underscored how isolated the Pope had become during the COVID-19 emergency and a sustained season of opposition from his conservative critics. He was utterly alone before an invisible enemy preaching to a hauntingly empty piazza. During the virus crisis, Francis has become a 21st century prisoner of the Vatican, as one of his predecessors was once known, robbed of the crowds, foreign travel, and visits to the peripheries that so defined and popularized his papacy. He will resume physical contact with his flock this week with revived Wednesday general audiences, but the meetings will be held in an internal Vatican courtyard before a limited crowd rather than the vast St. Peter's Square. After weeks during which Italy brought the virus under control, the country's caseload is rebounding, now adding more than 1,000 new infections a day, so there's no telling when or how more ambitious public gatherings and travel might return. What does all this mean for an 83-year-old globe-trotting pope and his ministry to the 1.2 billion member Catholic Church? Alberto Maloney, a church historian usually sympathetic to Francis, declared that the pandemic marked the beginning of the end of Francis's pontificate. In a recent essay, he asserted the tensions that had percolated throughout the papacy came to the surface during the lockdown and won't fade even after COVID-19 is tamed. In every papacy, there is a historic point after which the final phase begins, which can last years, Maloney wrote. For Francis, this point was the pandemic and his solitude before the virus. Papal biographer Austin Ivory confirmed that the pandemic was indeed a before-and-after moment for the papacy and for humanity itself. But he disputed that Francis was isolated and said the crisis had offered him an unexpected opportunity to provide spiritual guidance to a world in need. The pandemic, he said in an interview, had given a whole new impetus to the papacy to double down on its core message, articulated most comprehensively in Francis's 2015 encyclical, Praised Be. In the document, Francis demanded political leaders correct the perverse structural inequalities of the global economy that had turned Earth into an immense pile of filth. It is his conviction that this is a turning point and that what the Church can offer humanity could be very helpful, Ivory said. He is convinced that in a crisis, and a major crisis like a war or a pandemic, you either come out better or you come out worse. There are rumors Francis is writing a new encyclical for the post-COVID-19 world, but for now a key part of his message is embodied by a Vatican commission helping local church leaders ensure that the needs of the poorest are met now and after the emergency fades. The commission is providing concrete assistance. Every month or so, the Vatican announces a new delivery of ventilators to a developing country, as well as policy recommendations for how governments and institutions can rethink global economic, social, healthcare, and other structures to be more equitable and sustainable. The Pope isn't just looking at the emergency, says Sister Alessandra Smirelli, an economist who is a key member of the commission. He's perhaps one of the few world leaders who is pushing to ensure that we don't waste this crisis, that all the pain that this crisis has caused isn't in vain. In recent weeks, Francis has also launched a series of new catechism lessons applying Catholic social teaching to the pandemic, reasserting the Church's preferential option for the poor by demanding that the rich don't get priority in getting a vaccine, and that political leaders address social injustices exacerbated by the crisis. Some people can work from home while this is impossible for many others, Francis pointed out last week. Certain children can continue to receive an academic education while this has been abruptly interrupted for many, many others. Some powerful nations can issue money to deal with the crisis while this would mean mortgaging the future for others. These symptoms of inequality reveal a social illness. It is a virus that comes from a sick economy, he said. Those words were delivered to a television camera from Francis's library, hardly a headline-grabbing moment. It's the setup the Vatican has used since March when it suspended all non-essential activity and gatherings. More significantly, the pandemic has deprived Francis of one of his most potent tools, foreign travel. Ever since the celebrity-style globe-trotting days of St. John Paul II, the Holy See has counted on foreign trips and the accompanying 24-hour media coverage to get the Pope's message out to a wide international audience that might otherwise never pay him much heed. All summer there have been reports of priests, nuns, and ordinary folk around the world receiving one of Francis's famous cold calls, a bishop in Mozambique dealing with cholera and malaria outbreaks as well as a Muslim insurgency, an Argentine nun who cares for transsexual women. Francis still hasn't released a report into what the Vatican knew and when about Cardinal Theodore McCarrick 2 years after promising to do so. As evidence of the conservative wing's desire to look beyond the Francis's papacy, two books were published this summer by prominent Catholic authors. Both were titled The Next Pope. We've run out of time for this week on Religion in the News. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Visit our website at ncreadingservice.org to get podcasts of this and other editions of Religion in the News. And we'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.